8/10 of our trip to Israel. This will be next November, November 5 through 11. On day 10, we're going to be leaving Tiberias, go to Cana, a little village, scene of Jesus' first miracle. And then we're going to go on to Nazareth, the boyhood home of Jesus. We will drive to Megiddo, one of Solomon's chariot cities, the scene of the final battle at Armageddon. And then we're going to see the excavations in the Canaanite temple, stable, grain silo, shaft, and the tunnel. We're going to proceed to Acre, visit the mosque there, and then the Crusader fortifications. And then we're going to continue on to Haifa for lunch. Now, that's only one day. That's only half of that day, by the way. The other half, I won't go through that. We're going to go up to Mount Carmel, one of the greatest views of the plain of Jezreelin that you can ever get. They have a nice little statue up there to Elijah, and we'll look down at the probable scene of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. So that's day 10. If you'd like to go along, if you could give me a word to that effect, and we'll add you to the list. And that's for November 5 through what comes out to 15th, and plan for that, $15.99. We'll get 11 days there. We've stretched it out one more day so that we'll get in a lot of time in Israel. I want to ask us to remember in prayer the Warlicks. They had a special trial for them this week. Mr. Marshall Neal was doing some work on the house for them, and they came home. He didn't come home that evening, and they found him that he had apparently had a dizzy spell and had fallen off the ladder, fell and hit his head, and this is what they surmise, and found him dead in their yard. So let's pray for that. His wife is Hazel Neal. They live in East Point. Mr. Neal was 67. They have two daughters, Dorothy and Marcia. Anybody who would like to drop them a note or get in touch with them, they can get in touch with Jack or Jane, and if you want any further contact with them. I'm going to begin this morning by asking that we will turn the lights out, and we're going to look at just a few pictures, and let me explain what we're going to be doing with these pictures. I've taken just a few out of some of the pictures that I took when in Egypt back in 1981, and I've tried to give you something of representation of the setting in which our first miracle took place. For what we're going to do this morning is to look in Exodus in the 7th chapter, and we'll be in verses, maybe I ought to read this before we look at the few pictures and then get to the actual message. If you will, turn with me to Exodus chapter 7. Exodus 7, beginning at the 14th verse. This morning we will consider only the first plague of the 10. Exodus 7, verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water, and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And you shall take in your hand, the staff that has turned into a serpent. And you will say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent to you, saying, Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you have not listened until now. Thus says the Lord, By this you shall know that I am the Lord God. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul. And the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. Then the Lord said to Moses, Say to Aaron, Take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, over their streams, and over their pools, and over all their reservoirs of water, and that they may become blood, and there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. So Moses and Aaron did, even as the Lord had commanded.
And he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, and all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. And the fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile, and the blood was through all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the Nile. And 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. There in the reading of those few verses, you have a summary of this first plague which God brought to Egypt to strike at the very life stream of their nation. It's appropriate that we look at this first plague on this Sunday preceding the 4th of July. I think it has something very definitely to say to any nation, because God is bringing plagues upon Egypt, the Gentile nation. These are not judgments upon the theocratic people, Israel, whose king was God. But this is upon people, a nation, in many ways, like the United States of America. Certainly a nation that is not indulging itself in the unsophisticated form of idolatry of the Egyptians, worshiping Osiris and Horus and Anubis and the other gods. But nevertheless, a nation that is certainly indulging itself in idolatry. More sophisticated, more subtle, but nevertheless, a very, very raw form of idolatry. We will see the implications of this, but I would like, first of all, for you to get some mental pictures. So the best thing we can do this side of actually going there this morning would be to get a few pictures of the Nile and some of the setting around the Nile. So let's have the lights and let's look at these few pictures. Again, we look at the map of the world, focus in on the Egypt, and you can see it in the top part of the picture, the white section. You can see the Mediterranean, the top of Africa, and you may be able to see the blue line there through Egypt to the right portion of Egypt, of course, representing the Nile River. Now, the Nile River, the longest river in the world, stretches over 4,000 miles. The Nile is, as Herodotus said, Egypt is the gift of the Nile. To speak of the Nile is to speak of Egypt. Let's go a little closer. Again, a picture you saw last week. Poor visibility out the airplane window, but nevertheless, if you could imagine a greener picture, greener grass and an even sandier soil, you see the stark contrast between what is Egypt and what is Egypt in fact and what is Egypt in reality, because the green portion represents the irrigated, fertile soil on the sides of the Nile. It's particularly intense up near the Delta region, up near Cairo on up to where it flows out into the Mediterranean. One of the world's, some of the most richest soil in the world was the breadbasket for the ancient Roman Empire and was, of course, the lifeline for the nation of Egypt. This is a picture of the Nile as it's in Cairo. Cairo is near what used to be the ancient city of Memphis, one of the older capitals of Egypt. And we're looking at the Nile in that city, not too very far then from the Delta region, where it flows into the Mediterranean. We come down the Nile, we go down to Thebes. This is the capital of Egypt in the time of Moses. This is the capital of Egypt where it's quite possible that at this place, somewhere here in the Nile, it was here that Pharaoh went out into the waters for some sort of a ritual bath or a morning devotions, because the Nile was a god. It was worshipped as an expression of, one of the ancient beliefs was that Isis, the wife of Osiris, shed a tear, and as that tear fell into the mountains, to the streams, it caused the flooding of the annual inundation of the Nile. Let's look at another picture of this same area, give you an idea of some of the impact that the Nile would have had upon Egyptian life. These are papyrus plants.
The papyrus was a plant out of which paper was made. Also, ships were made out of this. Remember the little expedition? Thor Heyerdahl took the trip across the Atlantic and to the ship made out of this papyrus reeds. And I've taken this as a representation of the commerce, the trade, and all that the Nile represented to Egypt. It simply didn't produce water for irrigation for the growing of grain and other crops, but there were things that grew along the Nile, and it was also an inlet into which ships could come. Ports were established. It was a lifeline for trade as well. And representative of this is down at Thebes, the section of the river, probably where Pharaoh could very well have been when Moses encountered him. And perhaps these modern-day ships can remind us of the way it was in the days of Moses, when great barges would go up and down the Nile. It was up and down the Nile that great pieces of granite were brought in the building of the pyramids and in the temples. It was, of course, the place where the river was fished, and the vessels, they caught fish by net and by line. And so it provided for them food. It provided for them a route for ships to take and trade. Another scene about the same spot of the Nile, representing the irrigation system that was used as the Nile would overflow. In the month of June, the river begins to rise. May is its lowest point, and the Nile rises in June. And as it does, it just begins to spill over its banks, go out through the land on both sides of the Nile. And at that time, they move in to use this water to irrigate out through canals, and they create reservoirs, cisterns to catch this water so that when it recedes, they can still use that water for irrigation purposes. They still use some of the same techniques they did about 4,000 years ago, too. Here is a representation, or here are a few of the little... Well, you can read this better than I thought. I was trying to read it through my magnifying glass. It comes out right nice on the screen. These were supposed to guard the Bisera of the Egyptian dead. These are the sons of Horus. In a moment, we're going to get a little more detail about Horus and how he fits into this pantheon of Egyptian gods. The Egyptians were very religious people. They were so religious, they had over 80 gods at least. And they had... Osiris, the god king, and then there was Isis, his wife, and then their son was Horus. And here are household gods. Notice the Hapi, the eight-headed. Let's see, which one is that? That was the second one in. That is one of the god of the Nile. There were a number of gods associated with the Nile River, and Hapi was one of them, and keep that in mind. Let's go. There's another one here. On the far left, this is taken off of one of the tombs. I think this is probably off King Tut's tomb, Tutankhamun. He's on the far right, the boy king. Over on the far left, with the white garden hat, that is Osiris. That's the god king, and it was believed by the Egyptians that. Well, I'll give you that story in a moment. No need to duplicate. But keep this in mind, that when the king, the Pharaoh died, he took up a special place in the underworld as the ruler over the underworld. He was the Horus. He was the god on this earth while he was alive. And there is Osiris, very important god to the Nile. Keep that in mind. This is up at the Museum of Natural History in Chicago. And these are some of the little gods, statuettes of the gods that archaeologists have brought out of Egypt. The idolatry just pervaded the entire life of the Egyptians. It was not a little section. Egyptians didn't all march out and go to the temple on a certain day of the week and then forget about it the rest of the week. They weren't like the Americans in that way, that it permeated every day, everything they did. All aspects of life. Another picture of it. This, I think, is it's about as representative as anything as to what may have been the scene without the barge, without the boat here. But when Pharaoh came down to the waters that morning, because in the background, this is at Thebes, which was the capital of Egypt at the time of Moses. And there are the ruins of the part of the temple complex there at Thebes. And it could very well have been down to the bank that he had come. A much more elaborate scene. Some of that wouldn't have been there in Moses' day. Some of that was built later in the time of Ramses II. But Moses and Aaron encountered Pharaoh in the banks of the Nile, possibly a setting like that. And this is my long... I wanted you to see his face is covered up with the top of the screen. But through the temple area, you see the pharaohs left these pylons, stone replicas of themselves. I thought it was kind of symbolic. As you look at these stone pylons, these statues they left of themselves, exactly what happened with Pharaoh, Amenhotep, as Pharaoh went before him. What does he say? He says that his heart was hardened. And this is a picture that certainly symbolizes the way his heart really did become, like stone, resisting the command of God. We have a few more pictures of these of the same temple complex. You can imagine how ornate, how magnificent, overwhelming this would have been in its own day. Earthquake, fire, time, fires, invading armies have taken their toll on all this by now. But here are some of the other pharaohs who have left their statues to remember them by. Another pharaoh. The god Khalu. He was the god of creation, one of the gods of creation. It's the ram. He was looked at the ram because it was so prolific. That it was looked upon as being one of the gods of creation. He was also associated with the Nile. That's why I've placed it here. And a couple more pictures up where you go through this temple complex. Rams all over the place. This is their god of creation. May I say, just give a footnote here about this. We look at that and say, well, how can people believe a ram was as represented the god who was involved with creation? I think that's no more preposterous than the evolutionist who says that it is time plus chance. The evolutionist says that it's time plus chance, and that's how we're here. An accident, no acknowledgement of a creator God who brought all this into being, who spoke the word, and it came into life. The evolutionist may as well have a ram that he would bow before and thank that ram for producing. Matter of fact, the ram may be even more consistent. At least it's person or a thing. It represents what they think was some kind of a person. It's a living being. The evolutionist just worships time plus chance. Actually, it's his own mind. It's a creation of his own mind. So lest we get too haughty in thinking, my, how people could worship or have a ram representing a God who is participated in creation, let's not forget of the absurdity of evolution. And with this final picture, Pharaoh stares us straight in the face. And he may have had the features similar to this. Certainly the garb was about the same. As Moses met him at the waters, and as Moses encountered him with this appeal, let my people go. But he hardened his heart. I think that's the last picture. Of this. It is. Let's turn the lights on, please.
Thank you, Seth. Now let's look back in the text, please. Let's look in Exodus chapter 7. We must try to appreciate the fact that the Nile was sacred to the Egyptians. Egypt was dependent upon its waterways for their livelihood. The Egyptians even referred to the Nile as Hapi, the river god. It was around the Nile that commerce, shipbuilding, ports, food supply all came. It was vital to agricultural livelihood. The Nile receives its great water source from its headwaters, which we're not going to be able to see
in this, we can only get to Thebes. We must go much further. And we go down to what is called the Blue Nile, or the White Nile and the Blue Nile come together. The White Nile comes up out of the out of Lake Victoria, and the Blue Nile feeds water into the White Nile. They intersect it, I think, somewhere, is it near Khartoum, near in Sudan? And the annual rains, torrential rains that fall in the mountains of Ethiopia, fill up the streams, of course, come into the Blue Nile, and the White Nile join together. And in June of the year, the river begins to overflow its banks and goes that way up until, September, then it begins to subside again. And it was on that basis, or because of that process every year, that for, thousands of years, the earliest settlers in that region, as far back as we can trace it, about 5,000 B.C., they saw the advantages of that because of the rich alluvial soil that was deposited there. And it became highly productive, and a civilization grew up around the Nile. The Egyptians gave thanksgiving to the Nile. They worshipped it as a god. There was even the mythological story that it was a tear from the goddess Isis that produced this inundation. We have some records as to how highly thought of the Nile was by the Egyptians. And I want to read one of these, Hymn to the Nile. It must have been tops on the charts in the New Kingdom in the 18th dynasty. And I guess they had some hot rock group that must have sung this, that everyone would have listened to this and would have identified with these words. And here is a hymn taken from the New Kingdom period, approximately the period of Moses, his contemporaries. And here is an excerpt from Hymn to the Nile. Hail to thee, O Nile, that issues from the earth and comes to keep Egypt alive. He that waters the meadows which we created in order to keep every kid alive. He that makes to drink the desert and the place distant from water, that is his dew coming down from heaven. And a further word about the Nile. If he, the Nile, is sluggish, then nostrils are stopped up and everybody is poor. If there be thus a cutting down in the food offerings of the gods, then a million men perish among mortals. Covetousness is practiced. The entire land is in a fury. And great and small are on the execution block. But people are different when he approaches. Khnum, remember Iran? It's Khnum. Khnum constructed him. When he rises, then the land is in jubilation. Then every belly is in joy. Every backbone takes on laughter. And every tooth is exposed. The Egyptians they could spare no words for the rising, the flooding of the Nile, for it meant their prosperity. They would look at that like the businessman may look at the Dow Jones average. What is the gross national product? What is the interest rate? Well, that's the way they measured their future, and they rejoiced and made it a god. Psychologically, the Egyptians were dependent on their welfare for the Nile. Their calendar was built around the rise and the fall of the Nile. So their whole way of life was built around it. And this Nile had many gods associated with it. I think I should wait till a little later to describe some of their relationships, Osiris and Isis. But this is the Nile. And it also, of course, it produced, in its flooding, it flooded the marshes. And in the marshes, this is where hunting and fishing took place. It just brought life to the entire nation, and they worshipped it as a god. But now we encounter the text. And God tells Moses and Aaron that I want you to go to Pharaoh, and I want you to make this appeal to him. But in his refusal, you will touch the water with your staff. You know, that staff that turned into the serpent.
And so the sacred Nile is going to be absolutely, totally polluted. But when we come to this pollution of the Nile, and when we begin to study it a bit, we find that there are those who say, well, I think that something less than a great miracle took place. I don't want to weary you with this, but I think you need to know about this. There is a popular viewpoint on all the plagues, and you may as well get introduced to it now, because I'll refer to this again and again as we go through the various plagues and the effect they had upon life in Egypt. But also, how did they take place? Were they miracles, or were they simply an intensification of natural or almost natural disasters anyway? What really happened here? Well, there is a very popular view that with regard to the flooding of the Nile and the turning to blood, and I want to make you aware of it. I'm going to give you some quotes because I think it's wholly inadequate, and I think that it represents an attitude, however naive the person may be, I think it does represent an attitude that I think must be viewed with deep regrets. For example, here is a very common approach to this turning of the Nile into blood. Are you listening? I'm quoting. Deposits from the Abyssinian lakes often colored the flood water a dark reddish brown, especially in the upper Nile, that might well be said to look like blood. I quote another. Such an excessive inundation could further bring down with it microcosms known as flagellates, and associated bacteria. Besides heightening the blood-red color of the water, these would create conditions so unfavorable for the fish that they would die in large numbers as recorded. Their decomposition would foul the water and cause a stench. A commentary that graces, I'm sure, many homes, the Broadman Bible Commentary, Volume 1, page 336. Baptists should rise in arms at this kind of thing, but I don't hear them. But anyway, this is what he said with regard to the flooding of, or the Nile turning to blood. Several views are offered. Of course, the first, that it was actually, literally, it turned into a blood substance. But then views 2 and 3, blood was used to describe the reddish color of the water. That is one possible solution. Or 3, the term was used in a non-literal sense by a later writer, stressing the severity of the event, heightening the historical event by describing the polluting of the Nile as turning to blood. Did you get that? The writer, Dr. Honeycutt, at a Southern Baptist seminary, says that this is preferable, that what actually happened was that a subsequent writer, not Moses, of course, but a subsequent writer is heightened the historical event by his interpretation upon the event. And all it was just this red silt that came down the Nile, which it does on occasions. And he says, and I quote, "The reality of the event likely rests in either the second or third alternatives, better the third being the better option." And he says, "Whatever one's specific conclusion, the Lord's providence is the overarching theme of the biblical writer." I have a response to that. That is not the overarching theme of the biblical, the Lord's providence, because the Lord said, "I'm going to perform not works of providence, but signs and wonders." The word wonders, miracles, a supernatural display of my power. Honeycutt says further, "It would be tragic to emphasize the details of the narrative to the exclusion of the broader theological purpose." That sounds wonderful, but it is baloney. How can we be sure of any summation or summary conclusion if we can't even be sure of details? Liberal material, but they've departed. Quote from the Erdman's Bible Handbook, The whole sequence of events follows a logical pattern which could have started with unusually high flooding of the Nile, bringing down red earth in microcosms which polluted the water. That's a sign and wonder. Oh. And then even another commentary, which a professor from an evangelical seminary on the West Coast. The first nine plagues may be described as miracles of heightening and timing. The first plague would have been caused by unusually severe flooding of the Nile in late summer and early fall, washing down large amounts of red sediment from the highlands of Ethiopia and so making the waters appear as red as blood. I view these as inadequate, totally inadequate to explain this. I want to give you four or five reasons why I think this was a miracle and not simply a heightening of a natural problem. Can I give you those before we go on to the implications of this? Did you notice in the text that it said that what would cause this, what would cause the water turning to blood, would be that when he put the staff into the water, strike it, and it turns. Now that's extraordinary, isn't it? Think of what we must have if all it is the red silt coming down from the mountains of Ethiopia. Just at the right time, Moses maybe has, or Aaron has somebody running upstream. Here it comes. There it is. What do we take Pharaoh for anyway? How could this impress him as if at the striking of the water with the rod, all of a sudden the red silt shows up, which Pharaoh knew all about? How could that be a sign and a wonder to cause the Egyptians to believe that the Lord is the God? I think that argues for the fact that this was a miracle, not simply some secondary cause, not simply some heightened natural phenomenon. I give you another reason. The water became undrinkable. Why, it doesn't when silting takes place. Red silting is very common in the flooding of the Nile. And it does not bring about this widespread death of fish, and it doesn't create a stench that would seriously change the way of life of the Egyptians. It doesn't do that. And it's very doubtful that the presence of bacteria from the flooding waters would be so intense and multiply so rapidly so as to kill fish in great numbers and bring about all the results described in this chapter. I think that's totally inadequate to explain what they saw. I think the length of the time and the extent of this argues for a miracle. It lasted only 7 days. When the silt comes down the Nile from the mountains of Ethiopia, it doesn't just last for 7 days. But this lasted for a specific time period, and it stopped as quickly as it started. And the extent of the flood, all the waters, the reservoirs, the pools, you notice all those terms used there. These are the cisterns, and when the water would rise, it'd be taken out into these canals and these pools that had been dug to catch the water. All of that was immediately changed. I think another reason for arguing for this to be a miracle was the effect that it was to have had on Pharaoh. How could it have impressed Pharaoh if it were an annual event? And I might repeat, it was not an annual event for all the fish to die, nor for it to become foul and to smell the way it did. It was a blood-like substance. I don't think that it would not have to have been human or animal blood, but it looked like, smelled like, and tasted like blood if you were a man to try to drink it. So I think that's what occurred. After all, the scripture speaks of the moon turning to blood, Joel chapter 2, verse 31. And it's not a literal blood, so it could be describing and have similarity to blood. But whatever it was, when that Egyptian went in and came in from working in the heat and turned on his spigot and dropped a few ice cubes in his glass, and then out came blood, I don't think that he would have enjoyed that kind of Bloody Mary. That it would have been totally repulsive to him. Everywhere he went, he's thirsty, and he can't find anything to drink. The God that he worshiped is now humiliated. Now let's consider the implications of all this. So what? Well, in order to appreciate the purpose of all this, you have to understand the religious significance. Certainly it took away their agricultural livelihood for a while. And And as the Nile went, so went Egypt. I think the purpose, number one, was to demonstrate that God was the Lord. He said clearly, verse 17, that they will know, after all, it was Pharaoh who had said earlier, I don't know this God who you speak of. Oh, you don't? Well, may I introduce him to you? I would like to introduce the Lord God of the universe. I'd like to introduce the God of Israel, of the Hebrew people. May I introduce you to him? Watch what he does to your river god. Blood. That's your God, huh? He's able to do that. I want the Egyptians to know that I am sovereign over the very bloodstream, literally the bloodstream of your nation, of your civilization. Ironically, you know, they even believed that the Nile was a part of the bloodstream of the gods. God, as if he's saying almost sarcastically, this is the bloodstream of your God? You want some blood, do you? I'll give you some. Here it is. There's his veins. Look at them. Look at the blood. And it was to demonstrate that God was in sovereign control over Egypt and over the very thing they depended on for prosperity. It was a lesson that God was sovereign over all the gods of the Egyptians. Now, the Egyptians had many gods. Here are a few of them. The one that we are most interested in is the god, well, there are two or three. Let's see how many are in here. Here is the god Osiris, the god king, the god of the Nile. And do we have Isis, his wife? We have her. And do we have, we do not have Horus here, do we? Well, Horus was their son. But we have a nice little story about the gods. And it went like this. Osiris had a brother. His name was Seth. I'm sorry, Seth, but that was his name. And he had a brother named Seth. Seth was mean. He got jealous of his brother Osiris. And because everybody was loving and worshiping Osiris. So Seth killed him and dismembered him. Isis, the wife of Osiris, grieved for him. But then she began to go everywhere the body had been cut up and thrown. And she began to get all the dismembered parts of Osiris and bring them all back together again. And Osiris came to life. But Osiris and Isis had a son, Horus. And Horus eventually found Seth and banished him to the underworld. This story was a picture of the Nile and the relationship of the Pharaoh to Egypt. Because the Egyptians saw in the flooding of the Nile the tears of Isis. They saw in the life that it brought the resurrection of Osiris, the god. They saw in Horus, they saw him rule through the god king, the Pharaoh. For while the Pharaoh was alive, he was Horus. Mind you, this was not something that was just studied among the theologians at the seminary in Egypt. This was something that was a part of the daily life of Egypt. And they looked at the Nile as providing for them worship. Khnu was the guardian of the sources of the Nile, the god of creation. Hapi, the spirit of the Nile. Osiris, the god of the underworld, and the Nile was his bloodstream. Nith, one of the goddesses. She was a warlike goddess who took special interest in Thaletis, the largest fish to be found in the Nile. Then there was Hathor. I believe he's on here somewhere. Hathor. He protected the Cronus, a slightly smaller fish. Do you get the picture? Here is their whole theology, as it were, on this tapestry of water. Here was all of their theology, foiled right in front of them. Isis, Osiris, and Horus, and all the other gods. This was a part of their life. They believed this stuff. This was the Isis, Osiris, was the god of prosperity. And they offered thanksgiving and praise to him. And Aaron and Moses introduce the God of gods to the Egyptian theological system.
And God, in one stroke, by means of that staff, turned this water into blood. It's interesting, isn't it, that nothing that the magicians could do, they couldn't reverse it. All they could was duplicate it. Big thanks. That's really offering a lot. They could have duplicated it by some sleight of hand and produced water that had this blood-like appearance. But Pharaoh was impressed enough to say, well, my men can do that, and he walked away. What is the significance of this for our United States today? I think it's very plain. I think the significance of this in relation to God's attitude and response to Egyptian idolatry and refusal to accept his revelation is very plain. That our nation, other nations, have gods today. Communist countries have gods. You knew that, didn't you? Communism worships the programmed history to eventually result in a classless society. It worships the material in a crass and a raw way. Communism is a system of total idolatry set against God. Who controls that? Who's over that? God. I do think that our president was correct when he said, though I would make one slight adjustment to it, when he spoke of communism as the focus of evil in this world, I would say it is a focus of evil. I do not want us to cause to overlook other points of evil. But I would say that the communist system is a focus of evil. I couldn't understand why some in the press got alarmed at that. What's wrong here? And I think we will do well, and I think we ought to pray for our president, for his safety, because he is putting more pressure on the communist world than any president we've had, and I can't remember when. And I go all the way back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, at least as a baby. I can't remember any president bringing the kind of philosophical pressure against the communist world. Usually everyone just speaks highly and ignores these things. And I think we should pray for his safety. They don't want him reelected because he is calling things the way they are. That communism is evil. It's vicious. It's against everything that you would hold dear. Freedom, liberty, peace. Communists are not for peace. And we must be very careful when we talk about nuclear freeze and when we talk about dealing with them as if they were people who were just like we were. They aren't. Communists don't think like we think. They have a different worldview. Different concept of morality. I think the black people deserve a better representative, at least in the political sphere, than a Jesse Jackson. I think it's tragic with what he's doing. Being manipulated by a president of Syria, by Fidel Castro. Coming back and telling us, isn't it wonderful? Castro wants to have renewed relations with the United States. Let's just play like they're just people who've got a little different view of government than we do, and we'll just hold hands and dance and go down the yellow brick road of life. How naive can you get? How naive can you get? And a man like Jesse Jackson and others, that he represents a philosophy, and there are others that travel with him. I think it's a tragic thing to overlook the idolatrous system of what communism is. Well, let's bring it a little closer home. What about the idolatry in our own nation? I just listed a few of the gods in the Western world. May I introduce you to some of them? Perhaps I could get a picture of them somehow. But let me suggest some of the gods of our Western world. They're there. Sure they are. First, there is the God of Peace. There are people who worship the goddess Peace, who will bring peace to all who will make the necessary sacrifices, and we must do whatever we can to have peace, because peace is the most important thing in the world. We must be willing to disarm if we would have peace. We must be willing to do anything for peace. Wait a minute. Is that the ultimate value? Is it really? The opposite of peace is not war, mind you. The opposite of peace is true peace. Not false peace. And that we must not worship at the goddess, the shrine of the goddess of peace, by making sacrifices and surrendering freedoms. That's why I would say nuclear freeze. Who are you kidding? There is some young lady, young, I don't know, maybe she's my age, she would be young. They're talking about a vice presidential candidate because she goes around talking, and she supposedly has all this insight into nuclear freeze. And listen, ladies, you be wary of these women they would want to foist upon you as being a vice presidential candidate. You ladies deserve better than some of those who are being spoken to. And I'm afraid what's going to happen in this country is that in the hysteria of trying to get some kind of representative from every group, men, women, whatever culture and race, is that what we're going to do to just get a quota system is that we're going to check our brains at the door and try not and overlook that we're going after what's important philosophically. What is truth? What kind of principles do you stand for? The issue shouldn't be whether it's a woman or a man or a black or a white, but what do you stand for? What are your principles? I want to know what they think about nuclear freeze. I have one bit of advice to those who are for a nuclear freeze. Go talk to the Ruskies. That's all. Just go talk to them. See if you can get some kind of guaranteed controls. We're just talking to ourselves. The God of peace. Have another one. What about the God of prosperity? Now there is one. And the God of prosperity, and I guess if there is a life, the bloodstream of the God of prosperity, it'd have to be Wall Street. And many people build their happiness, their goals, their values, everything around the marketplace. Everything depends on that. Can I say something about the idol of prosperity? He makes great demands. Here are some of his demands. The God of prosperity says, you sacrifice whatever is necessary for the material wealth, because that's the most important thing. The God of prosperity says, you live if there is no eternity, only this life. The God of prosperity says, pursue happiness and self-fulfillment to the exclusion of all else, people included. The God of prosperity also says that you measure life in terms of money, material things. Let that be your criteria for judging the value and worth of people and things simply on a financial basis. Who are the adherents? Who bows down to this God of prosperity? Those who live for things rather than for godliness. Those who subordinate the work of God for the work of self-pleasure and achievement. Those who seek to lay up treasures on earth rather than treasures in heaven. Those who seek to measure everything by greater revenue. And that the measure of prosperity is simply in terms of increased revenue, whether it's for government or business or whatever. And that's the sole criterion by which they make that judgment. That's why I'm alarmed at the willingness of many to surrender some important moral principles and bringing in gambling to want to create a greater revenue basis. Now, Birmingham has done it. To their tragedy, I think it's going to be to their ruin. But we've got people now saying, well, we're going to be an international city. We need parimutuel betting. I'd rather not be one if that's what it takes. You tax the poor, you ask in organized crime. And I tell you what I have a statement for government. How about being more careful with what you have before you get any more? We're having trials right now in this state for people who could care less. We have a federal government that just burned up $11 million worth, $11 million now. You probably wouldn't pay that much taxes in a lifetime, but $11 million of wasted coupons. You remember the rationing coupons they made a few years back in the early 70s for the supposed gas crisis? You know what they're going to do with it? Destroy it. $11 million. You know what I want to... When a government does things like that to begin with, wait, I think, do they need more money? I think they need more sense. That's what I think. I think we need people who should have a greater appreciation for the value of what money is there. I don't believe we need to create that kind of a revenue base for gambling. But when we worship the God of prosperity, We say we'll bring in greater revenue for schools. You're not against schools, are you? Come now. We create a greater revenue base so that we can employ more people. You don't now come. You don't want people to be unemployed, do you? You'll never build prosperity by taking moral advantage of people. Never. It's never true prosperity. But when you worship the God prosperity, you're willing to do things like that. Beloved, I'm concerned lest we be influenced, and we are, but to the extent that we pull away from the worship of the only true and living God, do our lives stand as a testimony against the God of prosperity? How about it? Does my lifestyle rebuke the God of prosperity? Moses and Aaron rebuked the God of prosperity in the Bible. They rebuked it by a sign miracle. Do you know how God rebukes the prosperity God today? You know how he does it? He rebukes it by the greater works of believers. That is, the work of the Spirit through believers and winning men and women to Jesus Christ and producing the fruit of the Spirit in their life, and with the result of lifestyle, that it flies right in the face of the materialism of this world. And the world is uncomfortable around the lifestyle of believers because believers are not worshiping at that shrine, and the unbelievers are very uncomfortable with that. You don't worship the same God we do. Why? You have a different lifestyle. You have a different attitude toward things. You're not infected with this. I think that the Spirit of God's work in the heart of the believer to produce the desire to lay up treasures in heaven rather than treasures on earth. The kind of attitude which looks upon the things of this world as passing away. But what really counts is what is done on behalf of God for all eternity. And that means sacrificing time. That means sacrificing money. That means that I look as my first obligation when I get my paycheck is the work of God. That's my first obligation. But too many times when we begin to write our checks for our bills, it comes down to, well, let's run out of checks. Let's see if I have a dollar. And we come before the God of the universe and say, I'm sorry, I don't have anything left. And he says to us, who gave it all to you to begin with? Are we worshiping at the shrine of the God of prosperity? Well, it's a little more subtle, a little more sophisticated. We're not bringing flour and foods and wine and singing the praises of the Nile. But our lifestyle may defy and contradict everything that we sing and we speak of. Take my silver, take my gold, not a mite from thee would I withhold. We sang that a couple of weeks ago, and I caught myself in the middle of it singing. I said, do I mean this? We sing some deadly things sometimes. We don't think about it. Am I worshiping at the God of prosperity? And I'm telling you that our nation stands at a critical point in its history, very critical, because in our desire for national prosperity, as being the final criteria for success as a nation, as a people, we are doomed to drown in that sea of prosperity. And God will have us know, I am the Lord. Let's pray. With every head bowed and every eye closed, before I dismiss in prayer, I want to make this one thing transparent.